Hey, what's going on? Happy Tuesday. Welcome to Jay's Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. What are you laughing at? Did I get the day wrong again?
No, I'm laughing at your little hands going. Like, oh, for sure this boy's having Brazilian coffee right now.
Yes. Oh, yeah. We've got a lot of beverage talk to do before before we get into the Blue Jays winning a 2-1 game against the Texas Rangers yesterday, snapping their mini losing streak. What a Kevin Gausman game. We will get into all that. He outduels Jacob DeGrom. But first, I have two beverage-related questions for
Please.
You. The first is, and there are going to be follow-ups to this. What All-Star game is that mug that you have from?
This is Texas 2024.
Now, was there like an active war going on during that All-Star game or what? Like, I feel like you could fire a machine gun into that thing and it wouldn't even ripple your water in it.
It's so heavy. Let's start there. Just the bottle in itself is so heavy and it only holds, I think, 500, 600 milliliters. It's not really a good deal, but I will say this. It keeps it cold for like 48 hours. You can leave the water in there. And so that's a plus, I guess.
And again, you could have a live grenade go off in your backpack and your laptop would be exploded to smithereens, but your water jug would be perfectly
fine. Would save my life. Yeah, for sure.
The second question that I have, so you very kindly brought me in some of your Brazilian coffee today.
Yeah.
And it crossed my mind that you brought it in a mug that says something on it that is not in English.
Yeah.
And I could be sitting here with, and sorry to anyone who is a audio-only listener, with this mug facing the camera and Jennifer Rolnick does the single shot, so I'm in the thing. This could say anything on it.
Yeah, it says dumb foreigner.
Okay. It's like I'm with stupid pointing pointing up.
No, it's literally just, you know, motivational message. I think I got that as a graduation present. I'm not too sure, but it's basically like if you want something to happen, go ahead and do it type of thing. It's really not.
My other thought was it's like a live, laugh, love, but in Portuguese. You know.
Oh, nice Portuguese accent there, buddy.
I grew up in Cambridge. I got a little bit of it. Okay. Awesome Blue Jays game yesterday. It is obviously a nerve-wracking game anytime you win a 2-1 ball game, but you've got Kevin Gausman looking like absolute Cy Young candidate form Kevin Gausman. He is head-to-head against Jacob DeGrom, who didn't have his absolute best stuff, but it's Jacob DeGrom. We spent a lot of the show teeing it up yesterday. And it felt like there were some stakes, not only in that, I mean, it's May, so like how much can there really be stakes? Yeah. But John Schneider said after the game, the way that they played in Tampa Bay turned this into a little bit of a bigger series. Yeah. There is also an element of these two teams have both underperformed. They're in the same spot in the AL wildcard standings. And yes, it's early, but these two teams kind of hovered around each other in that space in 2023 as well. The Rangers obviously went on to win the World Series. The Toronto Blue Jays did not. I don't know. It feels like a relevant series, an important series, and what a game.
Honestly, yeah. It does feel like an important series, Blake. And maybe this is just my own sort of impositions towards the way that things were going. But with the way that things went in Tampa, I was ready to start talking about, is this another version of 2024? And I know that it's very early and, you know, the situation is so much more murky than it was last year when, you know, we were sure that the New York Yankees were going to win the division and there were clear front runners for playoff spots. This year, everyone is a little bit more in the middle and we understand that. And so it kind of delays these conversations, but still it made it an important series because we are knocking on the door of June and the Blue Jays are still under 500.
Under 500, still not in a wild card position. And yes, it's early, but you are mindful of not only your proximity to a wild card spot, but how many teams are in the mix with you. This is something we ran into heading into the trade deadline last year, where it wasn't so much that they were, say, five games out in early July. It was that you would have to beat out four, five, or six teams to get that because there are not really many bottom feeders in the American League other than the Athletics and the White Sox.
This man is going to sneeze. It took a while for this to happen in show. I'm proud of you for holding off as long as you tried. But
it's so nice to have a co-host where, like, the last couple summers, if I have one of my little sneezing fits, I have to just be like, excuse me, audience. I'll be gone for 4 or 5 seconds here. Anyway,
please don't do that again. That was weird.
That was weird. Okay, so yes. The other thing that's notable about where the Blue Jays are in the standings, and this is, I'm only bringing this up not to be negative about a positive game, and we'll get into all the specifics, but because John Schneider talked about it after the game, is that not only have they struggled to stay around 500, but we are far enough into the season that one of the better indicators of how good are you actually is your run differential. And the Blue Jays are very bad in run differential. They have the 11th best run differential in the American League, which isn't great. Now, there could still be noise, you know, you won some close games, you have a good bullpen, that kind of thing. But they actually haven't. They have a losing record in one-run games, so that doesn't make it feel any better. And 2015 is always such a rich example for this, where we all knew that the Blue Jays were better than the 500 team that they'd showed through about 100 games. Their run differential was through the roof. Yeah. It was a lot of the talent hasn't resulted in the win-loss, and there's probably some bad luck or poor sequencing or whatever you want to call it. And then they ripped off two 11-game winning streaks.
Yeah.
One of them, which I was remembering with friends the other day, and it was great. I was at Fenway for two games in that 11-game winning streak that they had. I would love another one of those, by the way, guys. I would love an 11-game winning streak where Justin Smoke is hitting grand slams in my lap atop the monster.
Right.
And Russell Martin is hitting extra inning home runs.
Something for people to reminisce about in 10 years. That's, you know, that's kind of what it will take, I guess, for the Blue Jays to... And they're not the 2015 team right now.
No, no they're right. And the point is they're on the other end of that, whereas that team was around 500 and all the underlying indicators were like, this team's really good. This team's really good. Just wait for it. It'll come around. It doesn't always come around. The 2023 Padres are a great example of that.
Yep.
Where they ended up, you know, manager gets fired after the season. They've got to revisit some things. But then you saw last year, they kind of ricochet back up to being where we expected them to be. So it doesn't always even out. In the Blue Jays case, you're not looking at that and being like, whoa, we should be four games under 500 and feel bad about that. You treat it more like you haven't played very good baseball and you're still around 500. Now get the let out and start playing some pretty good baseball. If Kevin Gausman pitches like this every fifth day, I'm fairly confident they'll play good baseball every fifth game.
Yeah, but, you know, he needs the run support. Not every offense is going to scuffle as hard as the Rangers offense is right now. And what a turn of events. I'm the one who's negative today. But, yes, it was an awesome game. And it was a nail-biter to the end. It was really, really fun to watch. But at the same time, the Blue Jays had so many chances to give him some run support.
Yes.
To allow him to make a couple of mistakes. I thought it was heartbreaking, honestly, that he left a fastball in the middle of the plate in the seventh to Alejandro Osuna. He hit a single, and then, you know, obviously he gets out of the inning, comes back for the eighth. But walking off the mound in that seventh inning, Kevin Gausman looked visibly frustrated with himself. And it's like, it's not your fault, buddy. Like, it's just, you should be allowed to make one mistake in that spot and still be okay.
And Osuna didn't, it's not like he crushed it.
Exactly.
It's like, I think it was like 92 off the bat or something. It's a very Luis Arraez, like, I didn't hit the heck out of this, but I hit it exactly where there's going to be no fielder. You know, a 200-foot line, soft line drive is the perfect hit if you're a contact hitter.
100%. And so it's tough, right? Because he deserved the run support. The Blue Jays had several chances to give it to him, and for some reason just came up empty way more often than not here.
Yeah, and this is a trend the last little bit here. You know, I went into some of their runners and scoring position issues over the course of the weekend. Yesterday, they went 1-for-12 yesterday. And here is, this one is fascinating. I tweeted this out, and it's, so over the last four games, they have gone 3-for-26 with runners in scoring position. That's bad.
Yes.
What's fascinating about it is that none of those three hits scored a run.
Yeah, the most bizarre one probably yesterday.
Yes.
In which Vladimir Guerrero Jr.
hit the ball too hard.
He hit it too hard to center field.
He hit the ball too hard. There was also an instance where with runners in scoring position, Ernie Clement flew out and it was not deep enough to Adolis Garcia, who can be a bit of a circus tracking in right field. But if he gets the camp under one, you do not want to send Alejandro Kirk running against Adolis Garcia.
Good arm, for sure.
Yeah, and the way the throw came in, they probably made the right call there.
I think so, yeah.
But yeah, 3-for-26 over four games, 29 runners left on base, and none of the only run that they've scored with runners in scoring position over the last four games was a double play ball with the bases loaded. So it's not even an RBI or a hit.
Yeah, it's not good. And frankly, Kevin Gausman deserved better. They managed to get out of it. Jeff Hoffman pitched well. No strikeouts, but that is okay. I think that sometimes we get a little bit lost in the strikeout numbers for the closer. But, you know, we can talk about Gosman first and go back.
Well, let's finish up on the runners in scoring position thing, because I know you had a particular issue with them not being able to execute against Milner specifically.
Yeah. I mean, this is a left-handed pitcher throwing 88. How do you get nothing done? If you're Bo Bichette, who's going through a little bit of a mini slump right now.
Yes. 0 for his last 16.
How do you not get anything done at that spot with those guys coming up in the lineup? He pitched two clean innings. It's tough. And also, how is this man's ERA in the threes?
Well, that I have an answer for. But yeah, so the seventh, he went clean. And then the eighth, Varsho dragged that lefty versus lefty bunt single.
Right.
It was that's the first time we've seen him do this year. It's the 32nd of his career. You know, lefty on lefty, let's drag it down the first baseline. He also walked Kirk in that inning. So they had two on with nobody out. But Anthony Santander gets turned around to the right side. He hits a line drive that's a little too hard for Varsho to advance. Barger goes lefty on lefty. They leave him in. He looks at three straight pitches. And then Ernie Clement grounds out in that eighth. And then, yeah, Bo had been up in the seventh and not been able to get anything done. As for Milner in general, the best I can come up with is this. First of all, it's probably fake. It will eventually, guys will catch up to him. You know, not in a, he's going to be DFA caliber, but similar to when we talked about how good Mason Fluharty was pitching early in the year. It's once a league's seen, you're a lefty that doesn't throw that hard, and there's some funk to your cutter sweeper combination. But once guys have a little bit of tape on it, they've seen a little bit, maybe you become a 3.5-4 ERA guy instead of a 0.00 ERA guy. In Milner's case, he has a sinker and a sweeper. And those two pitches, in terms of horizontal movement, no pitcher in baseball has a wider range of horizontal movements. His sinker has, where's my note here? His sinker has the 14th highest arm side movement of any pitch in baseball. His sweeper has the 28th highest other way movement in all of baseball. The gap between those two in terms of horizontal movement is over 34 inches.
Yeah, that's...
So when you think about plate coverage and what your approach has to be and what you're looking for, especially if you haven't seen a guy like that, I imagine it's just like, that is just so much width of the plate to have to worry about movement wise. He's probably just a tough guy to figure out first time.
Creeps up on you for sure. And
yeah,
you're right. Maybe it will even out once there's a little more data. Teams are facing him multiple times. It's just weird, right?
Yeah.
It's still, you know, you look at the numbers on the screen, it does not make any
sense. And I couldn't believe it when I looked it up, because you put it in the doc of, you know, how is Milner's ERA in the threes. So I dug in on him a little bit. Like, that is 34 inches of difference between the way the sinker moves and the way the sweeper moves.
So basically, you just got a lot of good pitching in this one.
Yes.
And not a ton of offensive production.
By the way, on Bo's 0 for 16 stretch, it is an 0 for 16 stretch. Six of those outs had an expected batting average of .450 or higher. So a little bit, he's getting BABIP'd a little bit in here, hitting the ball pretty hard during that stretch still. He took a walk yesterday as well. But yeah, let's get to the good pitching.
Sure. That's the main story. Absolutely.
Yes.
I don't mean to be the negative person today.
No, it's nice to switch the roles around.
It is, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. And sorry, one more thing on the hitting is that Jacob deGrom had zero strikeouts and only three swing and miss. That's the first time in 229 career starts that's ever happened for him.
It's absurd. And I mean, if there is one thing that this Blue Jays team offensively is really good at, it's staying away from the strikeout. I know that, you know,
I believe they're dead last in strikeouts.
You have Anthony Santander, who's obviously striking out a ton. George Springer is striking out a little bit more, but overall the Blue Jays are very good at, you know, not swinging and missing and things of the sort. But still, Jacob deGrom not striking anyone out for the first time in his career.
229 starts.
It's one of those, you can't really explain it. It kind of just happens, and you have to accept that it's a baseball oddity. And if you dig too deep into the numbers, you're just going to get frustrated.
And before anyone's like, ha ha, well, yeah, great, you didn't strike out, you don't have any power. That is true in general. They also had 11 hard hit balls off him, which is the third most he's ever given up in a game. So it's Jacob deGrom. The results were pretty good. I know they only got two runs off of him, but you didn't strike out. You hit 11 balls hard. That's a pretty good stuff against Jacob deGrom. By the way, if you have comments or questions and things like that, we are going to take some texts later in the show. You could text 590-590, leave your name and location so we can shout you out, send a question, send a comment, whatever. Standard message and data rates may apply. 590-590. We'll do that in the second half of the show. And look at that. It took me 15 minutes, but I remembered to mention that we're taking
text. Yeah, I told you I'd remind you, and then I completely forgot as well.
All right, it's right here in my document. I don't know what my issue is. All right. The reason that you I don't know the reason that you are negative today. The reason I feel positive today, even though it was a frustrating offensive game, is that Kevin Gausman, for his last two starts, has looked unbelievable. Yesterday, he goes 8 innings. He lost 5 hits, doesn't walk a batter, strikes out 6, does it efficiently. He only threw 12 pitches over the first 2 innings. He didn't even throw a ball until the 3rd inning.
Yeah, that was, I think he completed 3 innings at 23 or something like that. It was just so incredibly efficient.
Yes.
And you don't need to strike guys out if you're generating that much weak contact, right?
And it was mostly weak contact. The Wyatt Langford home run on a fastball that was in, and then Adolis Garcia had a pretty loud single on a fastball he left in the zone a little bit too much. But that's it. Even the Acuna one Osuna one that he was upset about was not like well struck or anything like that. It was a pretty low contact day for Gausman.
And honestly, if watching Gausman strike guys out with the splitter is still one of the best things about this team, but with the bullpen in the spot that it is, without Jimmy Garcia, with the amount of innings that they had to cover in Tampa, you will take a start like this over a 10 strikeout start any day. 5 hits, not a ton going other than the home run. 96 pitchers over mm-hmm. 8. So really, really good stuff. And good enough, honestly, that I was legitimately wondering if they were going to bring him back out for the 9th.
I think if it wasn't 3-4-5 in the order and Hoffman wasn't fresh, maybe you
and
do.
Maybe
but you
with a bit more of a lead, right? You build a stronger,
You also made the point that they had used the bullpen pretty heavily the day prior. Bowden Francis is going to start today, so you want a little extra, an extra arm or two available in the bullpen. Obviously, Jimmy Garcia is down now as well. So, it was an interesting spot. My guess is if it wasn't 3-4-5 in the order, he maybe would have got the shot.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. It's a
or
tough
like you
decision.
Said, if they had actual runs on the board.
There you go. It's a tough decision, but it also did give Jeff Hoffman a chance to, again, bounce back, because we saw him sort of, get back to form and then lose it again. And now, he gets his 11th save of the season, and we'll see where that goes.
Yeah, and it was nice to see. I mean, Hoffman wasn't, missing a ton of bats or whatever, but he was at least the nice thing you see is, there's a confidence where he's attacking in the zone. His fastball and slider were both mostly thrown in the zone. I think one of the flyouts was, a little loud, but the other two were, pretty routine fly balls. So, if the roof's open today, you don't want to pitch to that much air contact, I don't think. But, pretty good. Settle yourself in. Again, that was 3-4-5 in the order. So not an easy set of guys to mow down. With respect to Gausman, very good fastball game, very good splitter game. I want to do the splitter first.
Right.
Because we've talked about it so much. I did the Blue Jay Central 2 starts ago. The Blue Jay Central breakdown of his splitter moving kind of, I shouldn't say in the wrong direction, but getting so much left to right at the expense of depth. Yesterday was the most downward movement he has gotten on the splitter since August of 2021.
Okay.
On an average basis. So
really
it
quickly,
is.
I was so excited this morning, Blake, to hear the splitter stats, because we've been talking about it so much and it's usually negatively. I'm like, okay, we're going to dive into this and it's going to be great. He's going to have one of those where it's it's been 4 years since Kevin Gausman did this.
Yes.
And here we are.
August of 2021 was the last time he got that much downward movement on the splitter, which is great. This is back-to-back starts now in which the splitter has looked more like the 2021-2022 version. Again, not that it was, the results weren't all that bad before, but I talked to Gausman about it, and he doesn't want that left to right arm side run because it comes at the expense of depth. And as with most splitters, the more you can get that depth to carry the zone, the better it plays off of the fastball. So yesterday, really great movement profile on the splitter. He got 13 swing and miss on it. He barely threw it in the zone and they still swung at it a lot, which was great to see. And then the interplay with the fastball was really, really great. He got 15 called strikes on the fastball. And I really think that when you think about how the fastball and the splitter play off of each other, and I know Gausman has to cover up in the zone with the fastball too. It's a lot of fastball up, splitter low. But one of the things that I look for when Gausman's really on is when he spots the fastball low for called strikes as well. Because then it's like eye line wise and seeing the ball wise, you want to go fastball high, splitter low, and that's what deceives. But if you sneak the odd fastball low in there, a guy's going to see low and he's going to think splitter and it's going to dive. So you can steal called strikes sometimes if you're really on with both of those pitches. And we got a bunch of those yesterday.
Yeah. And, you know, the fastball has been the revelation this year for some reason. And it's because both, one, when he's good, you can see the difference in velocity and you can see the difference in location. And early on in the season when Gausman was pitching really well, he went through a little bit of a lull, but it was all about the fastball to the point where the splitter sort of took a back seat. And that is going to work for a bit until teams obviously start to notice that that's what you're doing, because the splitter isn't necessarily where you want it to be. So getting the splitter right was imperative to make this work throughout the season. But the fastball has been so good, and it's been good for a while. It takes me back to his start against the Red Sox early in the season, in which there was one point Rafael Devers actually swung under a fastball that was not in the zone. It was low and not in the zone, thinking it was a splitter.
Yeah.
And so that is how much it opens up to be able to locate that fastball all over the place. It keeps guys guessing to a point where they start to look foolish a little bit.
Yeah, and the swings can look bad, and you know, it's so fascinating because, like, with Gausman more than anyone, and I've talked about before on the show how I love talking about splitters because it's such a feel pitch and so finicky, but I also love talking about guys like Gausman who are, when they're on at least, primarily two-pitch guys, and you're going up there and you're the Texas Ranger, you know what Kevin Gausman is trying to do to you. You know what he wants to do. You know what the attack plan is. Gausman even, he was crediting Alejandro Kirk for his improvements as a game caller before the game, and he kind of alluded to that as well. Like, teams know it's fastball splitter, but you got to change up the locations, change up the sequencing, judge the swings and things like that. I think obviously things like the depth on the splitter is important. The fastball velocity is important. But if you ask me, hey, what's the one thing you, like, I go in blind and don't know what Kevin Gausman's results were. The fact that he threw 77% of his fastballs in the zone and they barely swung at half of them, I'm like, all right, he was on.
Yeah, he was. And I think it's important to sort of highlight the work of Alejandro Kirk. Mm-hmm. It's a lot has been said about the slow start, about the offensive profile. Who is he as a hitter? I think we are seeing who he is as a hitter now better than we were early on. And, you know, weird 2024 for him. He kind of comes in and you know, he says that he has never felt better both physically and mentally, and you're like, okay, I'll believe it when I see it, because it didn't show up right away, but now it is showing at the plate. One thing that you can count on is his defense, and now his game calling. And it's not just Kevin Gausman who's talking about that, it's Chris Bassitt as well, being like, listen, I gave up control of game calling for the past couple of starts so that I could get right. And so I'm trusting Alejandro Kirk here. That is huge. And that is why the Blue Jays were so adamant about locking him up in long term. You don't find those guys very often. When you do, you need to keep them.
Yeah, it's pretty safe to say at this point that Kirk is a top five defensive catcher in baseball. He's always had the framing and blocking stuff down. This year, he's doing a much better job controlling the run game. He's improved kind of his footwork and his transfer time. The arm's still not, you know, unbelievable, but he's gotten really accurate at that caught stealing behind a guy so that the second baseman or shortstop can get the tag on the backside as the guy slides past instead of trying to meet him at the base, because he just doesn't have the arm for that. And you add in the game calling and the way Gausman and Bassitt talk about him. Yeah, it's pretty hard to argue. And then all the advanced metrics agree as well. Pretty hard to argue Kirk isn't a top five defensive catcher in the league, if not even higher. I know Patrick Bailey and Cal Raleigh have a claim in there too, but it's a short list of guys that can compete with Alejandro Kirk. Running game, blocking, framing, game calling, and kind of check all those boxes.
Yeah, and yeah, listen, if the offense stays where it is, and the Blue Jays are going to be pretty happy as well. We haven't spoken about Dalton Varsho yet.
Oh, I had a transition.
Varsho,
so anyway, I to wrap up this note that Gausman's splitter was the best since 2021 in terms of shape and things like that. Dalton Varsho actually said, without saying that, he was like, very old Gauzy, like when he was in San Francisco. So when was he in San Francisco? Yeah. Back when the splitter looked like that. Yeah, Varsho, pretty much all the excitement on offense by himself in this one. He homers in the first inning, says after that, you know, he knows he struggles against sliders. Jacob DeGrom throws a lot of really good sliders. Pretty smart game plan to think DeGrom might throw you some sliders.
Yeah.
And then he leaves one middle low and Varsho jumps all over that, which he said rarely happens for Jacob DeGrom. Pretty good one for Varsho there. He also added a ground rule double and that bunt single.
Yeah, he's a triple short of the cycle, which is obviously the toughest one to get. But we have seen Dalton Varsho triple already this year. So you know, he came up, I think it was in the ninth he came up, and I was looking for that triple. I think he grounded out, but... you know, you know how hope works. But yeah, the home run was impressive in many ways. And one, it's absolutely, you had a game plan. You knew what to look for. Jacob DeGrom made a mistake. It just never stopped coming in on Varsho. And he's just going to go kind of where the movement takes, where the momentum takes him there. Hits it out of the park. That's great. Adds a double. And then what? I don't want to be too negative again, but, you know, it's been impressive to see the way that Dalton Varsho has swung the bat consistently. And I know that he's still striking out at a very, very high clip. It's probably still over 30% at this point, which would be a career high for him. But that's fine. I mean, he's still using the whole field. He's still finding ways to get extra base hits. He's gotten a ton of extra base hits.
He has. So he has 17 hits. In the 20 games since he came back. Only 19 of those games, by the way, he actually got a plate appearance in. So 17 hits in 19 games, basically 13 of them are for extra bases.
That's absurd. And it really does speak to, you know, the approach and what he's trying to do, the fact that he is not too concerned with pulling the ball, though that was a pulled homer yesterday. There's just no other way about it. But and that is still what I think of as a classic Dalton Varsho home run. But when he's trying to use the whole field the way that he is, when he's trying to stay back a bit and cut back on the strikeouts, that all points to more success and more diverse success in a way that we haven't necessarily seen from him since he came to Toronto on that trade. So these are all extremely encouraging signs for Varsho. He is a streaky hitter, but this feels like something different. It feels like more than just a good stretch for a guy like Varsho.
The only thing I don't understand about it is why, and this is not just a you thing,
yeah.
He keeps talking about the strikeout stuff too. He's got a career-high chase and whiff rate and strikeout rate. I'm like, I don't... If you are going to hit an extra base hit a game and have an RBI game, you could strike out in every other at-bat. I don't care. Why does it keep coming up how he's cutting or trying to cut down the strikeouts when the strikeouts are at a career high, the whiff rate, the chase rate, it's all at career high. And like, that is a trade-off that I'm just, like, projecting forward, you want to trim that stuff. But him getting asked after games about limiting strikeouts and stuff like that when he's swinging and missing a lot, I don't really understand. It's more like he's putting a drive into things. It's pretty clear trade-off. I don't know. He's brought it up a couple times, too.
Do you think it's more of a maybe a mentality thing of like it's not really something that you would expect a guy to achieve with that level of success right away, but just by keeping that in the back of his mind, it is freeing him up to do some other things?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, you don't want to go up there and be like, hey, I don't mind if I swing and miss.
That's all good.
Yeah. But speaking of, though, in terms of getting a pitch that you're looking for and jumping all over it, there was the DeGrom one, obviously, for the home run, the slider that he's looking for. On his ground rule double, his bat speed was measured at 86 miles an hour, which is one of the fastest bat speeds in all of, like, for any Blue Jay this year. Basically, the bat speed tops out at 88. No one swings a bat harder than 88, and even then, it's like the O'Neill Cruz types who get there once in a while. It was, I believe it was the fastest non-Vlad or Santander swing of the Blue Jays season. So he was, that tells me, like, bat speed isn't the most important thing, but when you get to that level of bat speed higher than usual, you were all over that pitch. You knew what that was. By the way, the 8 home runs in his first 19 games of the plate appearance, this is a Chris Black stat. In Jay's history, for the first 19 games of a player's season, only Vernon Wells, 9, and Carlos Delgado, 10, have more home runs.
It's impressive. It's impressive, and again, you look at what he's doing, and you say, well, Dalton Varsho is a streaky hitter. It doesn't feel like this is just a streak. And this statement may come back to bite me. It is only 19 games. But this is something that, I don't know, it's looking a little more sustainable. And maybe that does have something to do with mentality and with approach and with what he's trying to do. It just, yeah, I don't see him significantly cooling off unless something very bad happens.
Yeah, I mean, he's hitting really well right now. The argument for he will cool off is that if the power hits a bit of a slump, his OBP right now is 238. If the bottom falls out on the extra base hits, what that slump would look like or what that cold spell would look like is, you know, the underlying stuff says, oh, that would be a really cold spell. But for right now, there's not really an indication he's going to stop hitting the ball this hard. All of his, you know, the bat speed stuff, the quality of contact stuff, when you dig in and watch each of these extra base hits, you know, what he's looking for and his ability to attack it, just check off some of his weaknesses around the zone. All that stuff is where you want it to be.
Remember when John Schneider said that they didn't expect Dalton Varsho to save their offense? Well, yeah. Here we are.
Well, I will say, yeah, save the offense yesterday in that they only scored two runs and he was solely responsible for one of them.
Yep.
So, he's not going to get them 9 or 10 runs a game by himself. But nice that he did it yesterday. Let's take a break. Let's go around the major leagues with Jesse Rogers, VSPN on the other side. We'll talk to Ben Clemens of Fangraphs at the 11 o'clock hour as well. And in the second half of the show, we'll take some of your texts. You can text us 590-590. Standard message and data rates may apply. Your questions, your comments, where you're at with this team right now, questions you have for Julia and I. And a heads up that Blair and Barker move from the 2-4 time slot to the 4-6. Time slot starting today. So if you're looking for even more Blue Jays stuff and you are looking for more of Blair and Barker, in addition to Jays Talk postgame, they're now 4-6, which is the official sign. You know, people say Memorial Day in baseball is when you can start making sweeping evaluations and changes and things like that. For us, it's Leafs are out of the playoffs. Blair and Barker are back to the 4 p.m. slot. We're back to 2 hours. Let's take a break. We will talk to Jesse Rogers of ESPN on the other side as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. I keep wondering what feels different now that we're back to 2 hours, and it's not just having a co-host. It's I used to meticulously pick all the music for each time we came back from break, and I haven't been doing that in large part because most people listen on podcasts or watch on TV. Those people cannot hear the music. It's a little Easter egg for the radio only.
Yeah.
Can't do that. So we just get the Steve Slodkowski of Pup made. Take me out to the ball game.
That's great.
Okay. The Blue Jays had a fun one yesterday. The Chicago Cubs are having all sorts of fun. Let's go to Chicago. Let's talk to Jesse Rogers of ESPN about it. Jesse, good morning. How you doing, man?
I am doing great. Good to be with you.
Are you doing as great as the Chicago Cubs, who are on fire and are now tied for the second best record in the National League and got a terrific start from Canadian Jameson Taillon yesterday?
Yeah, I mean, his curveball is one of the best in the league. The opposition sitting 097 off of it. He's actually better against lefties because he throws his best stuff against lefties. They're hitting 192. So other than a few home runs here and there, he's been really good, but he does give up the long ball because he fills up the zone a lot. But the Cubs' offense is the storyline in baseball. They're averaging 6 runs per game. No team's done that for an entire season since 2007. I don't think they'll do it for a season, but they don't take away the wins in the first 2 months, and their offense has powered them to first place and all that stuff. So, yeah, everyone's happy in that Cub lineup. I mean, there's a fight at the bat rack because everyone's hitting right now.
That's a great saying. Fight at the bat rack.
That is indeed. We'll see if they can stay this hot all season. It would definitely be historic here, Jesse. And you look at the new addition of Kyle Tucker, you can't help but wonder how much he is a part of what is happening right now and really this amazing story that has been the Cubs offense. How has that fit been? What have you seen from Kyle Tucker in a Cubs jersey?
He's everything you could have imagined and more if you're a Cubs fan. And I say more because they're getting the best version of him. This wasn't Kyle Tucker 3 years ago. Every single year he's gotten better, and it's culminated in this ability at the plate to really just swing at strikes. Easier said than done, but he has more walks than strikeouts. Not easy for a slugger. He hits lefties, he hits righties. He's almost, in a lot of ways, slump-proof. Now, he had a little slump earlier, but he's always contributing because of that ability to master the strike zone, and he didn't do that a few years ago. So it's added something to his game. He can hit it to left. He can hit it out to right. He plays a great right field. He's your classic five-tool player, which is why he's going to command the next huge contract. And he's been a difference maker in terms of guys around him in the lineup. He's the protection that a superstar brings to the table. Why do you think guys in the Yankees lineup have great years when Aaron Judge is doing well? You know, it's the same thing here. The focus it takes away from the opposition on the mound is huge, and it helps guys around him. So that's why the Cubs gave up a lot for him. That's why he's going to command a lot, and that's why he's one of the elite players in the league.
Yeah, you mentioned the slump proof. It's so great. When a guy walks more than he strikes out, the bad days, you know, you're still taking long plate appearances. Maybe you're taking a free pass even if you don't get a hit. You're not having those quick 3-4 pitch at-bats and outs there. So sure, that's helpful to have in the lineup. Jesse, you alluded to a couple times there, the next payday for Kyle Tucker. How much do you find yourself, you know, obviously if you're a Cubs fan, you got to enjoy this season. You got to enjoy what Kyle Tucker is doing right now. But I would imagine that's at least a little bit in the back of the minds of not just Cubs fans, but someone who covers the team like yourself and the team itself as we kind of play this season out.
You know, in terms of Tucker and what he's going to command or if he's going to stay?
Yeah. Yeah, we're just kind of working through that, hey, maybe it's only a one-year thing, and if not, what does that price tag look like?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it feels like to me it's a one-year thing because we're getting deep into the season already. Now, is there a chance he goes to free agency and returns still? I doubt it. The window is now, but the closer you get to free agency – the more likely he is to test the waters. Let's see what the Yankees want to offer. Let's see what the Dodgers are going to say. So I just feel like, you know, they didn't do the trade and sign right away like the Mets did with Lindor or the Braves did with Matt Olson. It just kind of feels like he's going to hit free agency. Could be wrong about that. You know, there's always a chance things can change. And that price tag, let's just use $500 million as kind of the number. It's probably going to be higher than that, to be honest, if he keeps it up. If Soto makes $765, is he $200 million worse? Well, maybe, but that's still $565. So I think use $500 as kind of the number. Maybe it's a little bit more. Maybe it's a little bit less. Maybe it's a lot more. I don't think it's going to be a lot less. And that's kind of what you're thinking about with a guy like Tucker. He's 2 years older than Vlad. So there's a difference there, but he plays right field. He steals bases. Some people think he's better than Juan Soto. Now, he's not going to get $765, but he's also older than Juan Soto, but you see the range that he should be in. Based on precedent, it should be, you know, probably $500 million or more.
Yeah, I'm sure he was happy to see the Vlad number. And yeah, he is a little bit older, but I think definitively better than Vlad at this stage and has been over the last couple of years. So that'll be fascinating to watch. So Cubs offense, toast of the town. On the other side of the ball, Jesse, they have gotten some good starting pitching, but that Ben Brown spot in the rotation, and I know they lost Justin Steele for the season. Shota Imanaga is working his way back now. What's the, I guess, not even confidence level in the Ben Brown / Cade Horton part of the rotation, but just, I guess, when the offense is cruising like this, you don't worry as much about the fourth and fifth rotation spots being question marks, but how are they going to navigate that, you know, rest of the season, at least until Imanaga gets back here? Because there is kind of a hole there.
Yeah, no, there is. They had a rough series on the mound in Cincinnati, but they just destroyed Reds pitching. It didn't show up that much. But I think you're right. And if you believe in some regression, I mean, are the Cubs going to average 6 per game all season? It's rare that it happens, as I mentioned earlier. So assuming they come back down to earth there at some point, they're going to need some starting pitching to step up. And Ben Brown has kind of been shaky at best. Matthew Boyd hasn't pitched a full season in a while. Colin Ray hasn't been an everyday starter for a while. Like, there, you can make a case that there's going to be some issues on the mound that are lasting. So that's where the trade deadline comes in. I don't think they're going to blow the division the next month. And, you know, as we hit July, you can start to make trades and all that jazz. So they're a bit of a survival mode with Imanaga, but a little cushion here, assets to make a trade. I absolutely do think they'll go outside the organization to improve the rotation. Cade Horton could be that little, you know, silver lining, diamond in the rough kind of player that comes out of nowhere. He was a top prospect. He is a top prospect. Had an injury last year. So he's a guy that has more upside, where those other guys might have a little bit more downside as the season progresses. So I think it's a little bit survival mode until Imanaga comes back, and then you hit the trade deadline and you find a starting pitcher. It doesn't have to be top of the rotation, although it would be nice if it was. I think it just has to be a solid guy you don't mind pitching in October.
Jesse, speaking of trade deadline, you cannot talk about the trade deadline without talking about the bullpen. They go hand in hand, I feel like, for contending teams. And, you know, we're kind of watching from afar here and looking at Ryan Pressly. And I'm like, does Ryan Pressly not have a lot of saves just because the Cubs are just playing really well and scoring a lot of runs? Or what is it? And you look at his ERA, there was one poor, very poor outing in there, right? But six scoreless innings now for him. Yeah. What have you seen from Ryan Pressly in that closer role for the Cubs?
Yeah, look, he's not getting a lot of strikeouts, not a lot of swing and miss. So he lost his job after that big blow up, and he's slowly been working his way back to the good graces of the manager. So they're trying guys out right now. They have a guy throwing 100 miles an hour, Daniel Palencia. He blew a save on Friday, about a week ago in Miami on Monday, and then got the save on Wednesday, then got the save yesterday. So they're trying guys out. That's another thing they might do at the trade deadline, is go get a legit experienced closer. They need a starter. They need a closer to really round out this team. So maybe Pressly ends up back there, but he's not getting a lot of strikeouts. He doesn't throw as hard as you might like for a closer, where the strikeout is sort of a key thing there, especially with guys on base. So right now they're going with a youngster, Daniel Palencia. Mm-hmm. Like I said, 100 miles an hour. You got to give that arm a shot. I just don't think he has the experience to make it the rest of the season there. But he's going to be given a good tryout. And then, again, trade deadline might help them in that category as well.
Yeah, nice little shot in the arm from Drew Pomeranz, who's back in the league after a couple years as well for that bullpen in a support role. Okay, so the Cubs won yesterday, and they're going to see a couple more against the Colorado Rockies. And, Jesse, you, in a recent ESPN roundtable, you said you think three teams are going to lose 100 games this year: the White Sox, the Marlins, and the Rockies, who are already almost halfway there. when you look at that team, when you watch that team up close, I mean, 9-45, like, what do we do about this? They've been outscored by almost 200 runs already, and we're not even at the end of May. I don't know. I guess this is not really a question other than, do you have any thoughts on just how bad this has gotten, how quickly, for the Colorado Rockies?
Well, they've always been dysfunctional. The White Sox were dysfunctional the last few years, but before that, they weren't as dysfunctional. Right now, they're not that dysfunctional. The Rockies, I feel like, have been dysfunctional for a long time, and it's finally caught up with them. They also really don't have many leaders. Like, even the bad small market teams, you know, usually have a leader or two on that roster that can kind of help matters and direct and keep the ship afloat a little bit. You know, Chris Bryant maybe could have been that guy, but he's been hurt for so much of the time there. He's not even with the team. So that's not happening. So it's, you know, when you start out the season that they're having in record pace, it's a perfect storm of a bunch of different things. And it feels a little bit like a rudderless ship, especially with Bud Black gone. I thought he kind of held things together, but maybe his voice got old in that room. But they really don't have a player or two to sort of direct things there and keep it afloat, which means everyone's kind of just not going through the motions, but they're just in it for themselves in a way. They don't even know it. They're in it for themselves. But they're just kind of showing up. Yeah, they're probably putting in the work, but there's no real unity in the whole thing. And certainly not enough leadership at all. And leadership is not going to get you from, you know, 60 wins to 85 wins, but it might prevent you from a 40-win season, right? And they just don't have it there. That's kind of my look at the Rockies from 30,000 feet. It's finally all caught up with them.
Yeah, that's such a good point, Jesse. For things to go this badly, a lot needs to go wrong sort of at the same time, right? And I was interested in your predictions about who was going to win 100 games, lose 100 games. I think you know, no surprise in the 100-game loss category. However, you also predicted that no team is going to win 100 games, which is, you know, something that happened last year. But every year from 2015 to 23, at least one team won 100 games. I'm just wondering, you know, what you're seeing maybe from the Dodgers or the Cubs or teams like that that might be preventing you from seeing that 100-win season for anyone here.
I think it's more about the league than any individual team. We're just in a moment where there's a little bit more parity than normal. The American League, the parity is one level down compared to the National League. But the point is, the National League is kind of top heavy. I think they're going to beat up on each other. The American League isn't as top heavy. It still doesn't mean they won't beat up on each other. So in both leagues, I think there are reasons why we might not see that 100-win team. I also think in the Dodgers' case that they're thinking more about October. They're going to slow play it with Ohtani on the mound. They have all sorts of pitching injuries. They're not pushing the pedal to the metal, the Dodgers in particular, because most years I'd predict them for 100 wins, you know, with the roster they have. Also the Phillies, I think the same thing. They're thinking more about October, even though they're on a 100-win pace now. I think at some point, it's just going to take the pedal off a little bit. And again, there's a ton of parity in that division. Atlanta's finally righted the ship there. The Cubs might be on that pace. I just don't feel like they're going to get there. Something tells me they're not going to win 100, but they might get to 96, 97 the way they're playing. So it's kind of like, yeah, there's going to be a bunch of teams get close, but there's just going to be enough parity to prevent it from happening in both leagues. That's just my view. I don't have a crystal ball. It's just a guess.
Well, one thing that also happens in the National League, and you mentioned the Phillies there, is there are so many good teams that you have to play a lot of good teams. And you know, I know the Braves are a team that you maintain some optimism could fight their way back into a playoff spot in that NL mix, while the Phillies and Mets suddenly have to play the Braves a bunch. They got Ronald Acuna Jr. back on the weekend. Where is your optimism level that the Braves sit here two games under 500, five games out of a playoff spot, but a lot of time left? How confident are you that the Acuna return can give the Braves a little shot in the arm here the rest of the way?
Well, it's Strider as well is very important. I'm very confident. I'm very confident. This is a team that has pedigree. They've been there. They know how to do it. They're 4.5 games out of a wild card. I think you close the gap there first, then you start thinking about the division. But I'm not sure that they're this just might not be the year for them in the division because of the start they had. But you're not telling me that the Braves are better than the Brewers, the Reds, and the Cardinals? I think they are. Yeah. I do think the Diamondbacks have underachieved a little bit. But the point is, I think in 2 months we'll be talking about the Braves being right there in the thick of things.
Yeah, I was surprised also, just going back to that Memorial Day roundtable on ESPN, that I believe it was you, Jesse, who had the D-backs as the biggest disappointment so far this season. That also kind of stuck with me. But one that really stuck with me was that the most surprising thing so far when you look at the standings is the Orioles being last in the AL East. Yeah. So it looks like they are going to sell at the deadline. It would make sense for them to. And I'm wondering how much of a different layer that adds to a trade deadline when you have a team that was supposed to be contending for the World Series now, you know, taking that big of a step back and selling at the deadline.
Yeah, it's a surprise because I think it's a surprise to the GMs around the league. I don't think they thought we have to scout the Orioles, but I think in the next 2 months, you're going to see a lot of scouting of the Orioles from other teams. Now, it remains to be seen exactly what they're going to do. Okay, pending free agents, of course, but are they really going to rip apart the core, like Gunnar Henderson or something crazy like that? Someone asked me on another show about him or Jackson Holliday. No, I don't think so. I think it's your normal, let's get rid of some pieces that aren't going to be here. I don't know if Charlie Morton writes the ship. I doubt it, but someone might be interested. The key guy would probably be Felix Bautista, the closer. Like, closers become very valuable in July. And when you're not contending, you have no need for one. So a guy like him could bring back something. I think that's the potential. Some of the relievers, I don't see them ripping apart their core, but I haven't investigated it too much. I mean, it just depends on how far the Orioles want to go. So we'll see. But I would start with some of those pitchers, especially the closer. But yeah, it changes the dynamic because no one thought they'd be they'd be selling this season, and they certainly are going to be.
Yeah, it's a pretty big swing. Jesse, thanks so much for taking the time out this morning. We didn't get a time to ask you or to talk to you about it, but I just want to say terrific story on Christian Yelich and carry on Bob Uecker's legacy in Milwaukee a couple weeks back. I really enjoyed that piece.
Thank you very much. Yeah, he's a leader up there. He's the face of the franchise, and he's that leader the Rockies don't have. You know, you don't spend money. You're a small market team. But he leads that young group year in and year out. So I thought it was cool to highlight him. I appreciate the time, though. Yeah.
Thanks, Jesse. Jesse Rogers of ESPN. Yeah, go make sure you go check that piece out if you missed it a couple weeks back. The Brewers also a team hanging around 500 in the National League. Another team that it's a little early to start doing this stuff, looking at people's roster. Can I have that? Can I have that? But they've got a... Look, if Ben Nicholson Smith doesn't text me about Rhys Hoskins like once a week, I think his phone plan dies. So we'll see. Okay, we're going to take a break. When we come back on the other side, we're going to talk to Ben Clemens of Fangraphs. We'll also take some of your texts to 590, 590. Standard data and message rates may apply. Ask us questions. Let us know where you're at with the Blue Jays right now. You can go outside of the Blue Jays as well. It doesn't matter. We'll take a break. When we come back, Jays Talk Plus continues.
Teeing up the biggest games of the night, it's the Fan Pregame with Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert.
Weekdays at 6 p.m. on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, what's up? Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. You know it's the first week back to 2 hours because I'm having all sorts of stuff. Julia, you're the only one who's been locked in here for the first two-hour shows.
I was going to suggest that I sing us back from break. Mm. And I was like, did I actually say that out loud? Are they expecting me to sing? That's why we're not hearing the music.
Even our bosses are texting me notes they forgot to text earlier. Get it together, everyone. Everyone except you, Julia.
No, including me.
You're right on. And look, honestly, this Brazilian coffee. Whew.
Yes.
This is.
I told you.
You have now established, though, that there's coffee for me every day.
Yes, I'm happy to do it, guys. Okay, so Blake has this thing where he doesn't really like it when I do nice things for him. I don't know if it's something about me or if it's just a general thing.
No, it's being conditioned my entire life in my relationships with family and romantic partners and everything like that.
I'm going to keep doing nice things.
Yeah, I'm just not comfortable with it. All right. Speaking of nice things, for the first time this year, we get to talk to our pal Ben Clemens of Fangraphs, one of my favorite guests. Ben, what's up, man? How you doing?
I'm doing good. Good to talk to you, Blake.
Yeah, sorry to intro. Sorry you had to hear all that nonsense on the way in. Man, we haven't talked to you yet this baseball season. High level, how you doing?
I'm good. I always love when baseball comes back, and the thrill has not worn off. It's been another fun year. Yeah, that couldn't be better.
Fun year with some fun new toys. So... we don't have to get too specific. We can get as granular as you like. That's what this show does. But for anyone who hasn't seen yet, and Mike Petriello broke this down a little bit on Blue Jay Central last week, Major League Baseball released some even new data for us to play with over at baseballsavant.mlb.com, the StatCast data. This is a lot of bat and body tracking stuff. So last year we got to see bat speed. This year we get to see more approach angles and swing tilt and things like that. Have you gotten to dig in much yet? Like, what's kind of your first pass when that stuff dropped the other week?
I mean, I gotta be honest with you. I'm not smart enough to really know what to do with this stuff. Like, I've been spending a lot of my life analyzing baseball and not analyzing physics. And now I'm starting to wonder if I did that wrong. No, I mean, I'm not. I don't think I could actually do that and become a physicist. But I do find this stuff really interesting. Because I feel like it's telling us a lot of things that we thought when we watched baseball that we just weren't able to put in words. And it's both interesting when that lines up with what you think and when it doesn't. Like, to use a Blue Jays example, you know, you read all these articles and it's like the flattest swing in baseball with Vlad Guerrero Jr. And honestly, like, I saw that and I was like, Yeah,
well, what have we talked about with Vlad for years, right? Like, he hits the ball so insanely hard, but it's his swing profile does not necessarily give it enough lift. The other one that stood out to me was, And again, this is, I actually even have it in my notes. Like the first thing I did, and I was curious if you did as well, was look at, okay, here's things that I've always thought or assumed. Let's confirm that hypothesis or reject it. And the one for me was like,
yes,
Luis Arraez, the bat tracking data was interesting last year because slowest bat speed, shortest swing, that lines up with a guy who hits the way he does. And now we have like batting stance and depth in the box. I'm like, oh, Arraez is definitely going to be like a furthest back in the box guy. And then we get to see that one too.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I'll go a little off the board, but this is something that we could do for analysis of a lot of people in the future. I was looking at Victor Scott. He's on the Cardinals. If you're not like a close follower of the NL Central, you might not really know who he is. He's a really fast center fielder who can't hit, basically. You've seen the archetype before. But one thing he did is he stepped up like 10 inches in the box because he just has no power, like literally zero power. And so what he wanted to do was if he hits a fastball, he doesn't mind being a little early and kind of spraying it, or like a little late rather, like hitting it when his bat isn't quite squared up yet and hitting it to the opposite field. And I don't think I would have noticed that. I can't tell if someone's moving around in a box, but it's like, oh, this is an adjustment that makes sense. Hey, if you have no power, you don't care about pulling the ball because it doesn't matter. And if you're going to pull like a mistake, slow breaking ball, you can still do that. And I think seeing those changes is like really cool. The people who actually figure out how you're going to do this in some way that tells you a lot, like about everyone, instead of just doing what we're talking about and diving into an individual player. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah,
that
I mean,
sounds pretty hard.
That's like all this stuff. I feel very much about it, that it's descriptive, not prescriptive. Like it's great for us to tell stories. Hey, Victor Scott also opened up his stance to like almost a Rafael Devers level of openness. Like he's looking like prime Blue Jays Tony Batista in there with how open the stance is. So it's like, yeah, we can describe that. We can't say that like, hey, Kyren Paris is open, so that's good, or Ellie De La Cruz is more closed, so that's better. It's just storytelling. And yeah. Julie, I know that's the part that you are most interested in when we get this new stuff, is the storytelling aspect.
It's the digesting it for a wider audience. Of course, I know that no casual baseball fan is going to dive too deep into that, but still, you know, Ben, reading your articles, it's always fascinating to me that, you know, you take very, very granular things, you have GIFs in there, and you're, you know, explaining it and really contextualizing it, illustrating it. And I'm wondering how much of a challenge that is, how much fun that is, you know, and what your process is like, basically.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the most fun part of baseball, I think, is that, like, the person I talk to the most about baseball, aside from like people I work with specifically, is either my mom or my dad.
Nice.
And like, they don't know this stuff, right? Like they like baseball. They've liked baseball their whole lives. They don't like, you know, camera tracking that's showing like the angle of the knob of the bat. They don't know what that means. And so I've kind of always like wanted to do that, is like, hey, someone is putting out all this fancy data and you, the baseball fan who likes baseball, don't possibly have the time to learn all this. That's absurd. So like, let's talk about it. That because I'm more of a writer than a mathematician, but because I know a little bit of math, I think I'm pretty well suited to doing that. But I kind of just sit here and think, if I had to explain this to someone and they were going to stop me when they didn't understand what I was talking about, would I get very far? And then usually I wouldn't, to be honest with you. And so then I'm like, okay, let's smooth it out a little. Let's use some examples. Let's show a picture of it. And I just keep going like that until I feel like it's comprehensible without losing too much nuance. But honestly, like Blake said, this is a storytelling metric. And what's great about these is not that you can do the analysis on your own. It's that someone you trust to do baseball analysis can do a better job of this. I think like announcers do a pretty good job of using the StatCast data increasingly. And that is really helpful. Like if I can tell you, hey, the reason that this guy is pulling the ball so much is because he's actually just getting the bat head out in front. Like we can prove it. He's trying to hit the ball out front. Oh, neat. Now we can say that. Like, I really don't want to listen to a baseball broadcast and hear the angle. I'm sorry. I don't care. Like, oh, he's tilted at 38 degrees. No, I don't know what that means.
No.
But, right. Like, I think that is something that announcers will have to get used to. And, you know, they're still working on it. But what if I told you, hey, like, Bo Bichette is, like, maybe a little bit better low ball hitter than he'd be otherwise because he's able to, like, tilt his body a lot to get the bat down low in the zone. Well, cool. Like, great. That you could use that after he hit a low ball to explain it well. Mm-hmm. And I actually think that we're kind of in a golden age of being able to do that. And that's really what's exciting to me about it. Like, if you really want to predict the future of baseball, like, go work for a team.
Yeah.
But if you want to have, if you want to, like, feel like you understand what's going on, and not in the, like, I have a giant 18-dimensional equation that explains all baseball, but, like, I just saw a cool thing, how'd it happen? We've never lived in a better era for that. And so I'm very excited about that. That's basically why this season's been so fun.
That's a good point about announcing, right? You want to watch a baseball game and feel like you came out of it just a little bit smarter than before without being, you know, bored to death.
Yeah, and like you use the example of like you talk to your parents more than pretty much anyone else about baseball. So back in 2013 when I was doing a lot of hockey analytics blogging, when hockey analytics were kind of first taking off, I wrote this thing that was basically like the dad test, which was like at this point my dad still lived here, not in Newfoundland, and we would play shinny hockey on Sunday mornings together. And I took these hockey concepts. I'm like, if I can't explain this to my dad through the lens of the pickup hockey we're playing on Sunday morning, it's not useful. It's not being explained well enough. And your point about the broadcasters doing a better job of it, we're so spoiled with our broadcast where we have Dan Schulman and Joe Siddle and Buck Martinez. And Dan and Buck are such a good example because Buck knows all this stuff really well at the like field level and the like what – you know, what reaching out and what you need to do mechanically to go get that low ball does. And Dan is one of the very best in the business at taking, you know, someone sends him the StatCast stuff or he's looking up on himself. And if an old school guy like Buck, who knows it tactically on the field, and an announcer like Dan, who's in the numbers, if they can have a conversation about it, we know that we've like married those two things effectively together. This new data that we have to kind of capture stuff that baseball people have known, but now we have a vocabulary and a data set for
them. That's the future of baseball.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's a great way of putting it. The truth is that, like, look, we can talk statistics all we want, but what I want, and definitely what most people watching baseball want, is to have fun watching a baseball game and, you know, feel like they're enjoying it, feel like they're not necessarily learning something. I don't want to learn something every time I watch TV. That's definitely not the case. But, you know, like, feeling like they're like they kind of get what's going on and like what's happening is interesting. I actually think that like that's just going to get better and better. I usually watch whoever the home team is just so I keep all the broadcasts even. But I really like Buck and Dan. I do some away Blue Jays games. Buck's accent is just like one of my favorite things in the world. I don't know what it is, but he's from like 100 miles from where I live. And I've never heard anyone who sounds like that.
Yeah, it's great. And it's like a rite of passage as a Blue Jays fan. It's like every Blue Jays fan has tried a Buck Martinez impression at one point. Just like, you know, Harry Carey, everyone had a Vin Scully if you were a Dodgers fan. The other thing that I'm curious how much you did with this new data stuff is, you know, one of the things I like to do is like just look at the leaderboards and look at what looks wrong. So, for example, distance off the plate. It's all huge guys. Of course, you have this big, long swing. You're 6 foot five. You got these big arms. Of course, you're going to stand off the plate. And then 6 foot tall Gabriel Arias is the furthest off the plate guy that there is. And like, why are you in here with Goldschmidt and Judge and Ellie De La Cruz and Lawrence Butler and Shohei? You don't fit. I love stuff like that. Yeah. And I know, Ben, for this reason, and maybe not specifically with this new stuff, but like Isak Paredes is one of your favorite players to write about because he's such an outlier. Like, this is a weird guy. Let's dig in on what makes him so special.
Yeah, that's a great example. So every time that they come up with a new statistic, there's like good an article to write about Paredes. I think that's pretty fun. So like he hits all these home runs. And then they release swing speed, and they're like, he's the slowest swinger in baseball. You go like, huh? Well, that doesn't make any sense. And then you kind of write about that. It's like, how does this happen? Well, he's pretty good at pulling the ball. It's like, how is he so good at pulling the ball? Oh, look, like by the time that the ball gets to the plate, he's like way further into his swing than everyone else. And I bet you that like the more stuff that comes out, the more you're going to keep finding this stuff. I think that's, I think Vlad is actually like that too, where it's like every time we learn something new, it's like, how does he do this weird thing that he does where, like, I don't think anyone hits the ball harder to a wider, like, combination of like flat angles and high angles. He hits the ball hard on the ground the other way. He hits the ball hard, you know, in the air to the pole side. He hits the ball hard at every combination you can imagine. And how is he capable of doing that? Well, it's because he has this like pretty unique looking swing. And I think that's just neat that, like, I do like your rule. Like, yeah, I think with Arias, it tells us, like, he might not be tall, but he is ripped. And he really, really wants to, like, totally max out his swing, arms extended, like, all the muscles he can possibly put into it. And so the way he does that is stand far back and just try to unload. Jose Altuve actually stands pretty far back for a similar reason. His levers are so short that he really can get that full swing in and still be able to adjust. And so how do you take advantage of that? Step back a little bit so that these balls that are like in over the middle, he can really get extended on. With arms that size, it's easier to get extended. It sounds weird, but like, hey, look, we can look at it and say, oh, here's why he does it.
And why it works too, right? Yeah. Even though it's weird, there is a reason
even
why
though
it
it's
works.
Weird. Yeah. Yeah. And like, maybe you have to be like one of the best hand-eye coordination people to do it. And yeah, you do. Like, not every short person could just go become the best hitter in baseball. But yes, here's why it works if you can do this hard skill.
This has me thinking now maybe Addison Barger should try that as well, because he's a very, like, close-to-the-plate guy for as far as, like, the bigger, more muscular guys. Now, he's a little shorter than Arias even, and we'd have to dig in more. But yeah, this is the kind of fascinating thing. It's like, yeah, oh yeah, there's like a jacked guy corollary in the distance off the plate stuff. Okay, Ben, let's swing to some non-bat tracking baseball talk. I want to talk Blue Jays with you because I know you keep up with all 30 teams, and you and I have had some pretty fascinating conversations about this franchise over the last couple of years at the front office level, the urgency of this window, the future of Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and Bo Bichette and things like that. And here we are again, right around 500 with a top seven, top five payroll with an aging roster. I guess big picture, since this is the first time we've talked this year, where are you at on where the Blue Jays are right now?
I mean, I don't know what they could have done differently this winter. Signing Vlad to an extension has been like priority one, I think, if you want to be a long-term contender for a while. And they did it. So great. I don't like their payroll is they did the right thing. They're spending more money to try to back up the core. And now, do I wish Anthony Santander was better? Yeah. But like,
me too.
If you would, yeah, right. That's a tough one. But if you went into this offseason, like, I think the Jays did as good of a job as I could have done if I were, like, they probably did a much better job than I could. That sounded absurd. But there was no decision that they made where I was like, oh, I don't like that. Like, Andrés Giménez has not worked out so far, but, like, it was a great choice, I thought. It didn't cost them that much, and it both put their chips in the middle for now and kind of set them up to where they're not going to go off a cliff where they built to compete to 2025 and then don't have enough for next year. I think he was kind of a nice bridge piece. We can talk about him if you want, but I think he's been getting fairly unlucky this year, you know, before he got hurt. And I'd be pretty pleased to see him. I'll be pretty pleased when he's back. I think he's a league average hitter and has looked like one this year, despite the results being bad. Yeah, I don't know. Like, they're 500. But what did they do wrong to get to 500? It's not like there was some obvious move they should have made this winter that they didn't. Like, yeah, sign a great pitcher. Yeah.
Yeah, well, they went ahead and did that, and it just happened that Max Scherzer has been injured pretty much since the start
of
the season.
Like,
yeah.
And I liked the price they paid for Max Scherzer. Like, that was a perfectly reasonable contract for them. I thought that the deal for Santander was nice because, hey, if things go wrong, it's only like $15 million a year. Like, you can work around that. That's
heavily deferred, too.
Yeah,
exactly. Like, the net of that deal looks pretty good for them. It was good risk-reward. Things have not panned out yet, but not because I think they made a bad set of moves. You know, like you said, Blake, we always talk about this, and we often think, like, they're kind of like, you know, one foot's moving forward and one foot's moving sideways. Like, the head's not talking to the left arm's not talking to the right arm. This year was good. Like, this year they really did kind of have a lot of stuff moving in the right direction at the same time. And I don't know if it's going to pan out, but look, it's a tough division. You can't, like, just make a few offseason moves and have it all work out. And I hope that they're, like, heartened by like what they did, even if it hasn't worked out incredibly well in the early going, because like I would just be trying to do the moves that they did this winter more often. I feel like in previous years when we've been like, oh, they're not really doing this all right, it's been because they haven't done this stuff.
Yeah, Ben, you touched on the Vlad contract, and I'm sure this is also something that you guys may have discussed over time here.
A lot of times. lot of times with Vlad and Bo, yeah.
Simple as this, what did you think of $500 million over 14 years?
I mean, I like it. I think that it's very hard to find, like, the wrong number to pay these guys. I mean, that sounds crazy, but there just aren't that many players capable of being this good, right? Like, there's, I don't know, 15 players in baseball who can hit this well. And it's actually really hard to have a great team, the kind of team that the Jays want to have, if you don't have one of them. And they're hard to get. Like, you see what happens when they hit free agency. Like, people go completely crazy. Juan Soto got $750 million. Kyle Tucker is going to get a ton. And I think Vlad is a better hitter than Tucker. I think that Tucker might be a better overall player. But getting a chance to sign these guys and add a number that is not, like, going to completely break the bank or for a short number of years. Like, if you told me they signed him for 4 years and $60 million, I'd be like, well, like, that's good, but maybe I'd want a little longer. And if they'd also signed him for 30 years or something, I'd be like, well, that's too long. But I think this is a good mix. Like, I think this is a good mix of, you know, that you have all of Vlad's prime. And like, yeah, look, Blue Jays fans in 2037 are probably going to be like, we're paying this guy a little bit too much. But I don't know, like, that's a long time from now. I would be interested in having more of my value come in the present. I would be interested in having more of my value go to, like, true transcendent superstars. And if we're arguing, is Vlad a true transcendent superstar? Maybe that's a different discussion. But, I mean, I think he is. Like, I don't see a lot of arguments that he's not one of the best players in baseball. Like, he hits that way. He's hot and cold, but he's, like, really good. And it's hard to imagine, like, a Blue Jays team being better without him, even if they spent his money replacing him with other players. So, yeah, I think this is just kind of the cost of having a superstar. And, you know, they're spending, I think we have $250 million in payroll this year. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Vlad in the, what is it, 40 million a year range or so?
37, like, I think, yeah, works out too.
Yeah, that's 15% of your payroll. You're telling me that's too much? Like, I don't believe you. That seems like a totally reasonable amount. You're going to have a lot of guys on cheaper deals, right? That just naturally, the way baseball works, you know, Addison Barger is making the league minimum. Lots of your good relievers will end up making the league minimum. You should be able to pay a superstar 15% of your payroll and not really feel it. I think that the biggest benefit of this deal is that it's so hard to imagine how the Blue Jays could compete, because they're not, like, you know, winning the World Series every year. They're locked in this competition to make the playoffs. Take Vlad Guerrero off his team, and it's very hard to replace that offense. I think doing this is very important to kind of be able to think beyond 1 year, because it's not fun to have your team just be competing in, like, one-year windows. Like, I must win everything now. Mm-hmm. And then you get to next year, and you're like, well, crap, I made a lot of these bad decisions. Like, and I didn't win, so what do I do about it now? Now my team's worse, and do I look to the future now? Hey, now you can make these plans on 2-3-year windows. Now you can kind of make moves where you're like, I don't need this to work immediately. I'd love it to, but it doesn't need to. Like, if the Santander deal doesn't pan out and Vlad leaves after this year, that sucks.
Absolutely.
That really sucks. But if the Santander deal doesn't work out, if he's slow getting going and you're like, oh, we can run it back next year, and yeah, he's a year older, the core is a little aging, but we've still got the key pieces, that feels a lot better to me. And I think that's really a lot of what this deal is. It's a lot of money. It's not going to be some great bargain. Like, there's just no way. That's not how it works. It's too much money. But it lets you compete year in and year out and not have to try to stitch together these windows of, like, six players all hitting at once. And I think that's important. It just gives them a lot of flexibility to build great teams. And I wouldn't want to be the Jays and try to build around, like, I don't know, like, the next generation with no guarantee of that working. So awesome. Now they have an anchor.
Yes. You don't. Yeah. If things go the way that they, if they go a bad way and you don't have Vlad and it's suddenly the 18 and 31 Buffalo Bisons are your starting lineup next year. It's not great. And then, yeah, you have, you know, this is obviously paired with the extension for Alejandro Kirk, the acquisition of Andrés Giménez. You have a bit of a, not young, but like medium, like pre-prime, entering prime years, core to build with there. And then Dalton Varsho is probably a part of that as well. I only mention him because I know you're a big bunt guy. When guys bunt well and bunt successfully. I don't know if you saw last night, we got his first lefty on lefty drag bunt single of the season last night, the 32nd of his career. I don't know if that's enough to get a five things I liked and didn't like this week mentioned, but
it's a good bunt?
It's back for one night.
Was it a good bunt? I mean,
it was, yeah.
Like a good Varsho bunt.
Lefty on lefty, dragged it up the first baseline, pulled the first baseman off of first and beat the coverage.
Just booked it.
Yeah.
It was great. It was exciting.
I watched he did it all in that game then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I was watching the start of it and I was like, wow, he's the only guy who can hit DeGrom.
Yeah. Homer and a grand rule double and then a drag bunt single against the.
I turned it off too early. I missed the most exciting hit. Yeah, I mean, I feel like every time we talk Varsho, we don't know what to say because, like, we're like, he can't hit, but he's so fun, but he can't hit. Was this a good trade? I mean, I feel similarly about Kirk and Giménez, actually. You know, that is maybe something that the Blue Jays just like, now that you've said it out loud altogether, is that all three of those guys are, hey, if they are league average hitters, I like them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And because they can really pick it, but are they league average hitters?
Yeah.
It's interesting. Ooh, yeah. That's a good one, right?
That's a nice one.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like there was a little bit of an overcorrection for the Blue Jays after the way things went in 22, I want to say. And then all of a sudden it's like, you're getting rid of the players. We can't really play defense, but who could hit? And this is kind of where we are. There is one guy, and, you know, I just want to touch on this briefly, but there is one guy who can sort of increase even this window for the Blue Jays, and that's Bo Bichette, right? I think he's going to hit free agency. It doesn't look like an extension is going to happen anytime soon, but feels like a good year, too, for him to enter.
The most interesting name pretty much annually in your trade value column that comes out in July is how do we place this guy? Where's he going? And now he'll be half a year from free agency. I don't even imagine he's going to make the trade value column. This year so close to free agency.
Just too close, yeah. But, I mean, he's managed the one thing we thought he could never do, which is be just average hitting. He's just so hot and cold. Like, you know, every year I look and I'm like, well, he's either the best hitting shortstop or, like, unplayable. And it's just, like, for a week or two at a time. Sometimes a month or two at a time. He just can't figure out what to do. And then suddenly he'll just be scorching hot. This year he's kind of average. I feel like he's a good example of why the Jays are prioritizing these like defense first guys at so many other positions is that the floor with, say, Kirk is a good example of this. He did not hit the way we thought. You know, he's also an annual fixture on trade value series because I thought he was going to hit a lot more than he did. And he's kind of turned into a doubles only type power guy, which I didn't expect, but the defense keeps his floor up. It doesn't really happen with Bichette, right? Like, even though he plays shortstop, when he's not hitting well, he's just not really adding a ton of value to you at shortstop because he's not really going to wow you defensively. Not that he's bad. Like, I absolutely think he belongs there. But he is not one of the best defensive shortstops in the league. I think that the Jays have definitely been cognizant of that and not extending him because it really does feel like their MO these days is to have some defensive floor around their offensive, like, superstars. And I think it's tough. There just aren't a lot of shortstops who can fill, like, the really plus offensive, really plus defense thing. And they all make a ton of money because there just aren't that many of those guys. Or they're, you know, Gunnar Henderson, who doesn't make any money yet, but will. I do feel like Bichette's going to end up hitting free agency, honestly. And I'd be really fascinated to see him, like, to see how his career goes from here, because he's been just one of the enduringly most interesting players to try to get a handle on. I you know, I'm doing it with no fandom lens over it. And I just go like, I don't know, man. Like he was just incredible for 3 years, and then he was bad for a year, but I know he's still got the talent. And if you look at his kind of underlying stuff, I mean, it all looks pretty good. It all looks pretty similar still. It's very hard to figure out what can get him off and on. Like, often you can find guys and you're like, oh, their process breaks down for a while. And so, like, they're swinging slower or they're getting too chase happy. I have not really been able to pinpoint what makes the Chet go so hot and cold. Actually, if you had started out thinking of him as less good, like if you thought of him as a role player and he was now approaching a better form, I think I would enjoy him more. Because, like, man, when he is hitting well, it's like, oh, wow, what a boost to the team. I didn't see that coming. It doesn't feel quite so good when you're starting with him as one of the top line stars, you know?
Yeah.
Because then the down periods feel worse and the up periods are like, well, yeah, I expected that. But I think if you ignore that context and just like think of it that way, I'd be into it. I definitely think that he's been kind of disappointing to how I've been valuing him for the past few years. And I don't know why. And I still think he's going to turn it around. But, you know, this year's Boba Chet is not it. I don't know what he's going to do to fix it. I love that he's getting on base more now. I love that he's striking out less. But I just feel like he'll be able to pair it with the power, and he hasn't yet.
Yeah, and to your point about him being, like, the underlying stuff being less predictive for him maybe than other guys, career-best chase rate, career-best whiff rate, career-best ex-WOBA, so, you know, the kind of expected results based on the quality of your contact. And then, then this is the year that he's just settled in his average. It's
so strange.
Tough study.
So basically we have no idea when he's going in.
Even like him as a leadoff guy, and we've talked about this on the show, Julia, is like, I have so much trouble, you know, when he's struggling, because like my instinct with, especially in a leadoff spot, is if a guy is very swing happy, I'm like, okay, well, like, chill out, be a little bit more patient, see a few more pitches. But I don't want Boba Chet to do that. We know he's so good when he's like hyper aggressive. So he really is like he's just a tough study.
Yeah. I mean, there's this this old Bill James saying, good statistics are 80% confirming stuff you know and 20% stuff you didn't expect. And I feel like almost every statistic, Bichette is in that 20%. Like, and it's kind of nice. Like, if you see a statistic where you think you understand it, and then he's like way out of left field, you're like, oh, good, it works.
Yeah, that's great.
Like, he's so weird. Great.
Ben, speaking of weird and ebbs and flows, before we let you go here, an ex-Blue Jay you wrote about very recently, Robbie Ray.
Great piece.
Terrific piece. Look, it's great to see over 63 innings. This would be his third act as an ace in baseball. Not good, then ace. Not good, then ace. Injured a bunch, and now ace again. Are we buying it?
Yeah, I think he's going to kind of crash at the end of the year. He hasn't thrown a full season in a long time, and he hasn't thrown a good full season since 2021. That's really tough to keep that workload going. But I got to tell you, like, it's kind of back to what it looked like when he was good. And it's a hard way to be good. It's a hard way to be good. It's really tough to have a slow fastball be your best pitch and not really have a lot of other stuff. But like you said, you guys saw it before. He can do it. He is just, that fastball is just that good. And he is that good at throwing it when he's healthy. I think that it's probably going to be a case where the Giants, I don't know how they're going to protect his workload, because they're still in a pretty competitive race, and a lot of their other pitchers have been disappointing this year. So they're kind of like throwing a lot of iffy names into the rotation, seeing what'll stick. Like, Jordan Hicks is out; he's back to relieving, and they're just trying.
Hayden Birdsong, really, baby.
Oh yeah,
great name.
If you'll allow me a brief tangent, I sat down at a Giants game last year, and the 7 or 8 people in front of me all had Birdsong jerseys. And I was like, that's strange. And then I realized that's his family. That's definitely his family. This is his like first or second start in the majors. But at first I was like, wow, this guy is more popular than I thought. Jeez, I didn't even know there were 7 Birdsong jerseys in the stadium. So I think the real issue for Ray this year is going to be like, can he keep those mechanics up as he gets tired? because when he can, like, I actually really enjoy watching him pitch, because you can tell that he just hates throwing the pitches that aren't fastballs. He'll get in these counts where it's like obviously a slider count, and it's like he throws the slider and he doesn't even look like he's confident in it. He's like, why did I do this? Like I know that I meant to throw this. Every time he hangs a slider, he's just like so disappointed in himself. Like, I should have been throwing a fastball. It's a very fun watch, and I think basically he's got 150 good innings in him, and then if they don't give him kind of six-man rotation, rest him for the playoffs, that's one of those pitches that when he does not have the life on it, it's really bad. Because, like, okay, Robbie Ray, attack me with your fastball, and your fastball's not playing today, it doesn't work. So I think that you're going to see some pretty ugly games. And this is kind of historically what's happened to him. When he doesn't have it's bad. I think that right now, when he is rested and healthy, he's back to being... Like, that was a weak Cy Young season, I think you guys can agree. Like, if he was on the Jays, like, this year, I'm not sure he'd obviously be better than Bassett and Gausman as the best pitcher. But, it can work. And I think it is working again. So it's pretty fun.
Yeah, it's fun, fun while it's going... Right now, I had a friend who works for MLB on the social side at a Giants game the other week, and she texted me. She's like, Robbie Ray's doing this again? Like, where have I been? And I was like, no, this is news to all of us that Robbie Ray's back. Yeah, this is the weird rising slider. The fastball's only 93. Figure it out. It's a lot of fun, though. Ben, this was a lot of fun. Thanks so much for doing it, man.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks. This was really fun. I like the three-person dynamic here, Blake. Like, I talk too much, and it's great to be able to, you know,
no, this is great. We're also very happy.
Well, so.
Thank you so much.
Good talking to you guys. Absolutely.
Thanks, man. Ben Clements of Fangraphs. Make sure you're checking out all of his great work. In addition to the deep dives, the five things I liked and didn't liked every Friday or Monday on Fangraphs, kind of going over, I don't know, just stuff you don't see, especially, you know, like Zach Lowe on the basketball side used to do a 10 things like that every Friday for ESPN. And Grantland before that, and it was super valuable. But I do think in basketball, there's a little bit more space to watch nationally. Tune in. There's not a game every night. You get off nights to check out. It's more of a you check out the national storyline sports. So Ben's pieces are really fascinating for, I didn't realize Wilmer Flores was the most clutch hitter in all of baseball. Here's a little, you know, here's a couple paragraphs on this, and then we're going to highlight a Dalton Varsho bunt, and here's a cool base running play. It's great. It's a really good way to keep up with teams, with the sport outside of the team that you follow day to day.
Frankly, for us, especially because we are so locked in on the Blue Jays and keeping up and watching every game, it does get tough, I will say, to watch anything else. And so we kind of rely on guys like that who give us a little bit of a roundup. And yeah, he makes us sound a lot smarter than we are, Blake. That's kind of what I have to say.
Speak for yourself. Ben's the best.
You never sound smart.
No.
You're right.
No, okay. I saw your notes in the document earlier. Don't worry about it. Speaking of not sounding smart, we're going to take your texts in the next segment. Wow, how's that for some heel work? Some heel crowd play. Texas 590-590. Standard data and message rates may apply. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll answer some of your questions and comments in the text line. A couple good ones already coming in. Make sure to leave your name and location so we can shout you out as well. Again, Texas 590-590. We'll answer some of those when we come back. We'll also get you set for Nate Eovaldi against Bowden Francis in game two of this Blue Jays Rangers series. It's 8:05 tonight. That's next as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you across the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360 and Sportsnet Plus and in the Jays Talk Plus podcast feed. We're taking some of your texts. This is the first time we've done this year, but we got 2 hours to fill every day now. So we will be doing this a lot more. You can always text us to 590-590 during the show. Standard data and message rates may apply. We will do our best to get to them. And if we don't get to them today, we will save them for later if they are not particularly time-sensitive ones. Julia.
Yes.
What do you got for me?
I will take the lead on this one. I'll start with a very personal one. Will in Toronto says, tell Julia that Devers slander will not be tolerated. All I said was he swung under a fastball that was not in the zone. Yeah. That's all. That's all I said. He's still a very good player, and we're glad that the drama is behind us.
Speak for yourself.
I guess so. It was nice.
I'm going to text Will after. This is a friend of mine. I'm going to text him all the Red Sox slander he can handle.
Okay, let's
Rob
get some
Snyder begging to be a Blue Jay again, by the way. The "we suck right now"
what?
Quotes about
he said
the
Red Sox. He's tired of losing close games.
Yeah, and he said that they suck right now. He would be a great fit off the bench for the Toronto Blue Jays.
Yeah,
Rob Snyder would
probably
love to
get tired over here instead.
Come home. The Jays could really use a guy who just is outlier good against left-handed pitching only. Although the Jays never see any left-handed pitching.
They don't.
So anyway, what else we got?
So Julie from Guelph is sort of piggybacking off of Ben's words there about the front office and how it's performed, and Ben sort of saying that there wasn't much else that they could have done this offseason other than maybe signing a great pitcher. And Julie is asking, what about not signing Ryan Yarbrough? A big, obviously, conversation during spring training. After spring training, Blue Jays let Ryan Yarbrough go. He signs with the Yankees, and he's doing actually pretty well over there, Blake.
Yeah, he is. He's got a 3.06 ERA. He started a couple games for them, giving them some nice length as a swingman. And yeah, we weren't on the air every day, but we did a couple of opening week shows. We did an opening day show, and I expressed that I was a little surprised by that decision. They were only on the hook for $2 million if he made the team versus, you know, I think Jacob Barnes was at 1.4, but it was a split contract. So, you know, it makes a difference financially, yeah, but doesn't really. And I think the spirit of Ben's evaluation that he wouldn't have done much different than what the Blue Jays tried to do. I think he was talking more the big moves, the Jimenez,
yeah,
the Santander,
sure.
Who your 13th man in your bullpen is generally speaking, not going to be a move that fundamentally changes the outcome. Yeah. I would have rather had Ryan Yarbrough than Richard Lovelady.
For sure.
No disrespect to Richard Lovelady. But yeah, I was a little surprised by that one at the time. I don't think that move reaches the level like that. I don't think that decision reaches the level of impacting what Ben was talking about.
Yeah, for sure. Yes, it was a surprise, and you can look at that and say it was probably a mistake. You know, obviously you take away a guy that's doing well for the Yankees and you add him to your roster. It's kind of a double move in that way. But these little mistakes, I think they're going to happen. You are going to pass up on players that then, you know, reveal themselves to be
They didn't think with his stuff profile, with how soft he throws, that he had another year of being able to kind of smoke and mirrors his way through. But weirdly, the strikeout rate is like up through the roof, even though he's still only throwing 87, 88. It's an interesting one. Good for Ryan Yarbrough.
I know we were surprised when the Blue Jays didn't keep him. Are you surprised that we're still talking about this on May 27th?
Yeah. Yeah, a little bit. He did have I think he started for the Yankees. He had a spot start for the Yankees yesterday.
Start.
Yeah. And he went six innings with only one. So he's like in the Yankees rotation now rather than just being like a long man and a bulk guy. So I get why it's front of mind for people, especially when we're headed into Bowden Francis is starting today and Eric Lauer is probably starting tomorrow. I got it at the time with Richard Lovelady. I get it now that Eric Lauer is back in the rotation. I hope we're not still talking about it in July.
Yeah, same. Let's move over to the position player side here. Allen Niagara Falls. Once Andrés Giménez returns, we will have two starters batting under the Mendoza line. 200 batting average. Anthony Santander would be the other guy there. Do the Blue Jays need to trade soon for another bat?
Yes, but not because of batting average. Like, they're a league average batting average team. They strike out less than any team in baseball. I'm not as worried about that. If both those guys were hitting .190 and hitting for power, I'd be like, okay, whatever. I'll sacrifice the batting average. Even with those guys, even with some positive batting average regression, we knew coming into the year they didn't have enough offense. They are right around a league average offense so far this year, in terms of, you know, OPS and things like that. That's not going to cut it when you're in a playoff race. So I've felt since the start of the season they'll need to add another bat. It's not because Giménez is hitting under 200. It's just they don't have enough offense. And honestly, my priority would probably be someone who adds a little bit more power rather than batting average, which is team-wide something they do an okay job of, even with the struggles of Giménez and Santander.
Yeah, and listen, before he went down, Giménez is actually picking it back up. We're not going to see him hit, you know, three home runs in four games or whatever it was at the beginning of the season, but he was starting to turn a corner with the bat. He had hits, I think, in six straight games or four straight. I don't remember exactly what it was, but he was picking up and, you know, unfortunately goes down with an injury, working his way back now. We should see him relatively soon. But you're right in that this team's problem is not Andrés Giménez hitting under 200. It's the lack of power. And there obviously are some texts about that here too, with Ian Brampton offering a couple of trade ideas. Okay, so the first one is Ricky Tiedemann for Ryan Mountcastle.
Not giving up a top 100 prospect for a platoon bat that only has two home runs on the year. I know Mountcastle always kills the Blue Jays. Yeah. I absolutely agree that they need a right-handed bench bat. He has a 575 OPS, doesn't have years of control. You're only using him on the weak side of a platoon. Tiedemann is, even an injured Tiedemann is way too high a price tag for a Ryan Mountcastle.
Yeah, listen, Ryan Mountcastle, specifically at Rogers Center, he seems to hit extremely well. But then we also had Anthony Santander say that this was his favorite ballpark. And, you know, it's
It's one thing to target Ryan Mountcastle. It's another to give up one of your only good pitching prospects, even injured, to get that done. Ryan Mountcastle is the kind of guy that, I mean, we just saw the Blue Jays trade a bunch of guys away at the deadline last year, and the type of prospects they got back for platoon side part season rentals, that's the price. You're talking about your Yohindrick Penangos, your Charles McAdoo, your RJ Shreks. Those are the tier of prospect that you should get for a half season platoon rental.
The other trade that Ian suggests, though, is a more interesting one, and that is Luis Robert, who's on the White Sox.
Yes is my answer to a trade for Luis Robert Jr.
So, yeah, some of the names that Ian mentions here, Tiedemann, Leo Giménez, or Elvis Martinez, maybe even Alan Roden. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I'm a lot more interested in Luis Robert Jr. Because the upside's higher. He's younger. He's an everyday guy. He adds a speed element that you have on the roster, but not quite at the level of some of the teams you're competing with. And there are club options for each of the next 2 years. So if things work out, there's a little bit of club control. So it's not just a pure rental. I will say he is hitting 191. he has also been, by wins above replacement, league average so far this year, and he really struggled last year. So, you want to see him turn the corner a little bit offensively. You want to see him stay on the field health-wise. But, yeah, there's probably, and this is going to apply to more than just the Blue Jays. This is going to apply to the Phillies. This is going to apply to any team looking to add offense. There is probably not going to be a higher upside position player that hits the market at age 27 in trade between now and the end of July. So, that's a fun, it's a fun name to kick around. I don't know exactly what the package would be when he's playing so poorly and the team options get spicier beyond this year. But yeah, he's phenomenally talented, and I don't think a guy with that skill set is becoming available elsewhere.
And the Blue Jays will add another outfielder, and then they'll just figure it out, right? I don't know if he plays corner outfield spots or if he's a center fielder only, but that stuff
should
be arranged.
Play corner outfield spots is what is how I would describe that. He is only played center field. I believe the metrics are like he's a slightly below average center fielder defensively.
Yeah, well, stick Anthony Santander in there, and Luis Robert is now your DH. Do whatever it takes to get some more power into the lineup.
Other way around. You would move him to right field, I think, with Barsha in center, and then Santander and Springer can split DH. I don't know. You'll have to add a bat at some point somewhere.
All right. So staying on the offense here, Frank in London is asking about Bo Bichette. So is Bo batting leadoff set in stone? Should we try Jonathan Class A?
I mean, this is a conversation you and I had with Dan Schulman yesterday, and whether it's in the one spot or the two spot or just to mix it up a little bit, I'm certainly at a point where I would like to see Class A get more playing time in general, see what that on-base profile can do, see what speed can do a little bit at the top of the order. I don't think set in stone. No, Bo's not set in stone at the top of the order, but until someone like a Class A runs with regular playing time and makes a case, there's not a natural option. Like George Springer, you could have put him back up there at one point. He has completely cooled off right now, cratered really over the last 2 weeks. Yeah. No one else fits the profile. Class A is the closest thing, but even then, like we talked about it yesterday, and then he wasn't in the lineup. So
yeah, seriously,
hopefully he's in the lineup today.
Hopefully. We'll check on that. I think that's all we have time for,
yes,
Blake.
That is probably all we have time for. But
we do have some more here, and we're going to keep them in the dock because these are good questions. And, we'll have time to do it soon.
Yeah, we'll continue to sprinkle it in throughout the shows the rest of the summer. Yeah. So text us 590-590 whenever I remember to ask you for texts, and we'll save, especially the ones that aren't time sensitive. Yeah. All right, we got another game tonight, 8:05. It's Rangers against the Blue Jays. It's Nate Eovaldi against Bowden Francis. Eovaldi comes in with a 160 ERA, his sixth straight year of sub-4 ERA when healthy. The big asterisk with him always. But strikes a lot of guys out, gets a lot of ground balls, and he has just stopped walking people in general. If you were looking only at righties, arguably the best right-handed curveball in baseball, the best results on a right-handed cutter in baseball, I still maintain that Drew Rasmussen's is a little better, as I said last week, but they're right there metrically. And the Jays have seen him a lot and had some success, actually. Hit 341 against him as a team with a 519 slug. Alejandro Kirk, Vladimir Guerrero Jr., Bo Bichette all have had some success against Eovaldi. On the other side, pardon me?
Promising.
Yes.
Promising.
On the other side, it's Bowden Francis. He has only gotten out of the fifth once in his last six starts. I know there's a question about that in the text line as well. We will probably revisit that tomorrow based on how Bowden Francis' start goes tonight. Hopefully, it's a little better than it has been. The Jays need it, especially with a TBD in the probable pitcher slot tomorrow. That's it for today. Thanks to Ben Clemens and Jesse Rogers for joining us. Thanks to Amit Mann, Austin Mackey, and Jennifer Rowling behind the glass. Blair Barker, 4-6 now, not 2-4. Have a wonderful Tuesday.